Good morning. This is Right Here, Right Now, brought to you by Right Choice Services. At Right Choice Services, we develop individualized programs to help clients find that book inside of them that they've always wanted to write. I'm your host, Tim Morrison. On Right Here, Right Now, we interview business leaders, entrepreneurs, and professionals about their work and the writing they engage in as a part of their work. My co-host and producer for Right Here, Right Now is Andy Lowe. Andy has his own show, Renegade Radio, on Business Radio X. Good morning, Andy.
Good morning, Dr. Tim. How are you?
I'm doing great today. You were kind of moving about the mixer last week.
Well, I don't know. I thought you were the belle of the ball down there. People were coming out of the woodwork to talk about writing books. So.
Well, your wife was the belle of the ball. I might have been the beau.
All right, fair enough. We'll go that route. That sounds better.
You got a good-looking wife.
I got lucky.
You did something right, didn't you? No, it was a delight meeting her and talking with her and seeing all the people she knows.
Yeah, she's definitely my better half and my best foot forward. So
that's great.
There you go.
And the mixer was good for all the BRX people, I think.
Yeah, I think we had a good time, and it was great to see all our hosts out and all of our past guests coming through as well.
It's a fun time. It's a fun time. Well, you know, for me, there is excitement each Tuesday as I enter the studio for the weekly edition of Right Here, Right Now. I know that the guests come with their unique perspectives on life and work, and today is certainly no exception. One of our guests is Ms. Susan Anderson. She's the founder and CEO of the ArtReach Foundation, and Ms. Anderson is establishing an important U.S. initiative called ArtReach Project America, to help the United States military personnel returning from Iraq and Afghanistan who have been diagnosed with post-traumatic stress and mild traumatic brain injuries. Robert Falkender is a retired Army officer. He's a businessman and a college professor. He's a graduate of West Point, has his ring on, so I'm going to behave myself. I don't want to get knocked with it. And while in the military, he earned an advanced degree in operations research systems analysis from Georgia Tech. And in retirement, Bob has taken an interest in writing. In his first book, Bob wrote about his military experiences based upon his first tour in Vietnam. Now, in the promo that I had on the website for our show, I suggest that an apt theme for today is writing that emerges from terror, torment, and tribulation. Studies and personal experience tell us that writing about challenging, pain-chilling experiences can help us move on after the trauma. So we're going to kick that idea around a little bit, and as regular listeners know, if I've got a lady in the studio with me, she gets to go first. So, Susan Anderson, welcome.
Thank you, Tim. I really appreciate having this opportunity.
Well, it's good to have you here. Bob told me a lot about you, and he didn't tell me the half of it. That's a good thing. So, tell us about the ArtReach Foundation.
Well, the ArtReach Foundation started out with me boldly getting on a plane and going to Sarajevo in 1999, and I wasn't prepared for any of it. I wasn't educated to take on the idea of helping people who had trauma in their lives from war. But, you know, you never know when you're going to get that spark, that passion that causes you to sort of take a right turn and go off track and say, maybe I can do something here. And you're just driven. And in my case, I started the ArtReach Foundation. Pardon my voice because I'm suffering from a little bronchitis. But my program started in 2000 with getting recruiting art therapists from the Metro Atlanta area to go with me as a team, and we worked with 67 schools around Sarajevo. Now, you have to realize this is about 5 years after the Dayton Accord. So, though everybody had gone to their corners, the trauma was so abundant and so obvious. And there was an attempt to basically put life back into some sense of normalcy.
When you went to Sarajevo the first time, what did you have in mind? Were you just going over? Who sent you? What made you take that right turn?
That right turn came from a conversation where literally I felt my heart race. I thought I was going into some altered state, and I hadn't had a thing to drink that would lead me to this, or I had a tummy full of food and some really nice folks around me, but I asked the question, what has happened after the Bosnian War?
Mm-hmm.
Because the people that I was in conversation with all had had an experience of either serving as a humanitarian and going into that country during or after, or they were supporting the rebuilding of mm-hmm. the country in some form. And everybody said to me, as I'm having this physiological response in my body, everybody said, oh, there's not a single child that hasn't seen a dead body.
Hmm.
And when I thought of our own population, I thought, how many kids do I know that have seen dead bodies, other than those that perhaps would be prepared mm-hmm. for a family funeral? But to be part of an environment like that, it has to change you, and it has to inform you in terms of how you look at the world going forward. And you have to go back in my life to about 20 years before, when I had studied an introduction to art therapy. And I kind of came away with a sense that this is an interesting way of using art to help process and move out difficult things that you don't always find words for.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I got this big idea of, what about putting together teams, kind of like Doctors Without Borders,
mm-hmm.
and taking professional creative arts therapists who have that master degree credential and have practices, and taking it to a post-conflict region. So that's where the ArtReach Foundation was born. 5 years in Bosnia, reported influence to be 275,000 children ultimately were benefited by our program after training 500 local citizens, refugee, camp workers, teachers, administrators in our program. And then I came back and said, what next? And the what next became a call from the governor's office of the little state of Arkansas, who said, can you do what you did in Bosnia? Can you do for us? Because in 3 days, this was 3 days after Katrina hit the Gulf Shore, can you come and train our teachers and social workers and counselors on the method that you used in Bosnia? I laughed and said, here we go again.
But
and that's prior to Project America, which didn't come until years later.
But at least you knew the language, didn't you?
I knew
in
the
Arkansas.
Language. Right, in Arkansas. Well, there are variations. But yes, I knew the language. And in fact, I had relatives there. So,
but see,
it was
me,
a whole new world.
That's, to me, is part of the mystique and the amazement of what you've done, because you would have had to work through translators.
Yes, we did.
In Sarajevo.
Yes, in Bosnia we worked through many, many wonderful young English, actually a lot of university students who were honing their craft and mm-hmm. developing their skill and were eager to have the chance to translate for us. So that was one way that I did not tax or use donor dollars. I used university students in giving them summer jobs.
Mm.
And we worked with them. And by the way, they were just as traumatized.
I'll bet they were.
Because they were babies or young children, and now we're university students and carrying these sacks of
and that's
trauma.
All they had known.
Right, right.
What was it like working with a translator?
It slows down the pace, which is perfect for working from the emotional, psychological aspect of, mm-hmm. of ourselves. Sometimes there's a rush. I want to get away from it. And you want to just pace it and, mm-hmm. and bring it down to a more comfortable level of where the emotions are measured down in to be able to allow you to get the feelings out and not race through them or disconnect from them.
Sure. Did you learn any of their language and yes. try to use it?
Yeah. Oh, I mean, I spoke like a 3 or 4 year old.
Well, I understand that.
But, you know, it to be able to just say good morning
mm-hmm.
or to thank them or to say I love you in the other's language
mm-hmm.
is a connector that is so powerful.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. When I lived in Ghana, I learned the language, and I would actually preach in it, because I learned early on that I wasn't sure if my translators were saying what I was saying.
Well, that's another story.
And so then the other thing I noticed is when I would get into the pulpit, many of them would just put their head down. So when I started speaking in Ewe, they sat up and listened, and I loved it. So what was that other story now? You got me going. What was it like to speak in the language? Did you have some of those oops moments?
Well, yeah, the first oops moment was when I thought I had gotten together enough money to take the first team over, and that might be a nice little mission, and we'll work that summer and do good work to give back something that we could offer, albeit it took me 1 year. I went over three times the year before to make the necessary contacts and to feel that we were being truly invited. So I had the approval of the Ministry of Education that I work for, but we also had people that came from large organizations like UNICEF and World Vision.
Oh my.
And Catholic Relief Charities. So they sent their refugee camp workers, social workers, to take our training too. And we worked in a very concentrated kind of way, but boldly, and this is where you really do have to keep your own ego in check. I'm standing in front of the opening ceremony for the first program that summer in June of 2000, and there is a press corps who have come, because this is a big deal, if you can imagine. They're happy to see the Westerners who are showing an interest, because in 2000, many of the NGOs, the non-governmental organizations, were at that point turning to the next place of crisis and conflict.
Okay.
So there's a life for an organization within a post-conflict region. The hope is to turn it over to the indigenous population and go on. So everybody was leaving when we came in. And one of the first questions to me was from the press corps was, "So, Mrs. Anderson, why are you coming in now?"
Oh.
The questions were very direct and quite aggressive. And another one said, "So, are you doing this for yourself, to make yourself feel good as an American, or are you really coming here?" And I was challenged by this, and there was a place in myself that has a little bit of a fight that wanted to say, "I'm coming here because I felt I had something to offer."
Mm-hmm.
I did say that, but I boldly said, and this is where I was like, I said, "What?" I said, "I'm making a commitment to come back and bring teams to work with the children and the parents for the next 5 years." And inside I went, "You said what? How are you going to do that now?" So believe me, at the end of the fifth year, I took a deep breath and I went, "I did. I actually did it."
Wow.
Yeah. So what next? And that's when the phone rang a few months later from the office of Governor Huckabee.
So how do we fast forward us then from that to what you're working on now with the ArtReach America?
Well, that's another good story, and I feel like I'm taking a little bit of time.
Hey, I'm in charge here.
Okay.
Unless Andy does something over there.
No, I would not dare jump in here.
Okay. Well, the story goes that I literally thought, though my heart was still, a piece of me was still in Bosnia.
Mm-hmm.
And we had left trainers in place, a really core group of trainers who were taking our program on and teaching other teachers and other social workers how to use it. So I felt good about that, and I felt a little sad because I really felt like we completed our task. I completed my promise. And now what do we do? And we went to Arkansas. We worked there. It was quite an interesting story. When I was asked by the authorities, "What will it take to get you here? Can you come here next week?" And I said, "I am a one-woman show. There is no way I can raise money. The big boys are pulling the money in for the Katrina needs, and they'll do the job. This is the time for triage. We come later when the effects of trauma really do settle in." And so I said, "We can probably in a couple of months get there, but we're going to have to figure out how to raise the money." And it was quite interesting because the governor's office said, "Well, how much do you need?" And I choked because it had fallen on me to raise the money for those first 5 years in Bosnia, essentially 6 years, because I went a year in advance. And I, gosh, it was like you're asking how much is it going to take? Okay, well, we'll put together a budget. Because the idea was it was going to come from the discretionary funds of the governor's office. It was going to come from the task force for the homeless, knowing that these people could end up being the state homeless.
Oh, sure, sure.
And it was going to come from a little bit of FEMA money. And so that bore the cost, and we essentially, for the first time ever, became a contractor.
Wow.
Yeah, I was like, oh, okay, this is a different model than what I had used in Bosnia. In the meantime, our global effort, the beginning in Bosnia, got the attention of members of the royal family in Jordan.
Oh, my.
As a result of Project Bosnia, I was invited to come speak to a group of women at a conference on Rhodes, Greece in 2002. And it was all about the work using the arts to help heal a culture, to create dialogue, to help break stereotypes. And in that opportunity that I had in the middle of Project Bosnia came an invitation for us to come to the Middle East.
Wow.
Strange stepping stones, right? Bosnia to where we are located now in the Middle East, based in Jordan. But Jordan's royal family members and the National Gallery there gave the ArtReach Foundation a collection of art to tour the United States for 2 years, coming with the message of have a platform to talk about your work and how the arts offer and foster an environment to create dialogue, to break stereotypes of the other.
Oh, my. That's powerful.
So for 2 years, we did that.
Uh-huh.
And we launched it thanks to the work in Katrina. We met the people at the Clinton Presidential Museum, which had just opened, and said, open that exhibition here. At that exhibition, members from the University of Southern Mississippi said, bring it to Mississippi, to Hattiesburg, Mississippi. The exhibition is called Breaking the Veils, Women Artists from the Islamic World.
Wow.
So, I mean, I feel like the ArtReach Foundation has walked in light to avoid all the politicizing, all of the association with elements that could see us as some kind of strange radicalizing effort, when in fact we're simply a humanitarian effort that uses the arts to help heal from trauma, plain and simple.
Is part of, let me
guess. This is how we got to Project America, because I'm about to tell you.
Okay. Well, is part of your program, does it involve writing? Art, we think of drawing, sketching, whatever.
No. We start with the image. We start with guided meditation first.
Okay.
Which will allow you to relax and breathe into what is going on within your own brain and experience and emotional landscape.
Okay.
And out of that comes perhaps an image that we encourage. Maybe it can be a mark on paper, but that mark is attached to a sound, a word probably. And from that, it's the word that comes out of the image.
Okay.
And our program is all of those integrated modalities of art, drama, music, or sound, movement, and the written word, poetry.
Wow. Well, I'm going to give you an opportunity here because I would like to talk to our other guest. He's been patient, hasn't he?
He is really. He's such a good guy.
Well,
not characteristic.
He's ready, and I haven't even introduced him yet. But before I shift focus, how do people contact you? They want to learn more about the ArtReach Foundation, ArtReach Project America. They might even want to give you some money.
I like that idea.
You like that idea? how would they be in touch with you?
The website, artreachfoundation.org, or they can write info@artreachfoundation.org, or they can call 404-264-9349. And I'll be happy to return the call.
You'll be glad to talk, won't you? Well, I'm sure you're willing to sit by while I introduce and talk with Bob, and then we'll get everybody going together again, okay?
Okay.
Thanks. So, my friend, Robert Falkender, welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
You told me that Susan was going to be a light. You spoke the truth, but she was more than that. She was the whole orb, right?
Exactly right.
That's great. So you're a West Point graduate.
Yes, I am.
Proud.
Class of 57.
Oh, you're old.
Yeah, very old. That's what my grandchildren
say. You don't look at it like it. I mean, you look hale and hearty. What was your first stop after graduation from West Point?
Well, the obligatory airborne and ranger school for an infantry officer, and then I was assigned to Germany, Bamberg, Germany, 2nd Platoon, 15. Company B is the 15th Infantry, Audie Murphy's old platoon.
Uh-huh.
My first command.
Those things just roll off the tongue, don't they? And
it's
out of the memory. So how did you wind up in Vietnam?
Well, as a professional Army officer, sooner or later we were all going to get there. I didn't have to volunteer. I knew that, in fact, I told career management, I don't want to go any place cold, we said. And they said, we have just the place for you.
You did know what you were asking for, right?
I knew where I was going to be going.
Mm-hmm.
I did not know that I'd wind up as an advisor in the middle of the Mekong Delta, but that's where I started, and that became the source of my first book there, Filtered by Time.
Well, how many tours did you do in Vietnam?
I was there in 1964, 65, and again in 69, 70, just after the Tet Offensive.
Was there quite a contrast between those two tours?
Absolutely. The first tour, we were advisors. There were no professional Army military units there. Everybody on the ground was an advisor, at least in the military. The second tour, I was assigned to the 1st Infantry Division, and that was classic infantry organization. I was the executive officer of the 26th Infantry for a while. Eventually, I was an assistant operations officer, and then I was the assistant chief of staff of the 1st Infantry Division.
So let's put that in civilian terms. Did you sit at a desk, or did you go out and break a sweat?
Well, the first half, I went out and broke a sweat, and the second half, I cooled it.
Commitment have its privileges from time to time, doesn't it?
It does. Although there are times change, I thought going into Vietnam, my second tour as a major, I at least eat with the officers. I went into the mess hall, and the first sign I saw that said Lieutenant Colonels and above, and I was back in with the troops.
Oh.
So field grade major didn't make it to the...
Didn't make it into the elite.
Senior,
huh?
No,
wow.
Not yet.
What were your personal reactions? Can you recall from the first time to the second time when you went in and it was a hot war, so to speak?
Well, the first time I was there as an advisor, the year that I spent there and the year that I wrote about in my book, I thought we were doing a great job.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, in line with what Susan is saying, I wrote the book because my wife told me to do that.
And you do everything your wife tells you to do, right?
Well, when she...
Remember, this is going to be forever. So watch what you say.
When she hands you a little ticket that says, here's a class on how to get published, that suddenly goes from a wish to, okay, I'll do that.
Great.
And
okay.
But what I discovered is the discipline of writing it under the course created an outlet in a cathartic way that you've been talking. I created a composite character there who was the source of all information to young captain. And I got into that to the point where that character took over. I could hardly wait to write the next chapter to find out how that Major Bass was going to answer that captain's questions.
Well, that's a critical piece that you share there, because I know in writing, people who go with fiction or creative nonfiction, as I think this really would be categorized, say that the characters do take over. You can start off thinking you know where the story's going, and then all of a sudden, you've been kidnapped.
Well, and that's exactly what happened. Things that I had never verbalized mentally or much less wrote down, feelings that came out were suddenly transferred into a sentence. And, I had not thought that way before. This book is creative nonfiction, is probably correct. If you look at the cover, you'll see a monk on the front. So what's a monk doing on the story of Vietnam? Well, I did not realize at the time I was there that every time something happened in a violent way, there were monks in the wings.
Imagine that.
Yeah, Vietnamese monks, and they're different kinds of monks. But
well, they were Buddhist monks.
They were Buddhist monks of the Vietnamese sect. There were Cambodian monks, and there were Cao Dai monks in the area. Mm-hmm. But the Vietnamese monks had, and we did not know this at the time, at least certainly captains in the Mekong Delta didn't know it, and I'm not too sure that our government knew it. But the Vietnamese monks became very organized and not typical of the religion against the South Vietnamese government and Diem in particular.
Mm.
And in the very Byzantine way, acting against Diem and anybody who supported them, they were in the wings, probably a part of the National Liberation Front, mm-hmm. at least supporting in a way of information, intelligence, and observations.
Well, if you were to write a second book, which would detail your second tour, how would it differ?
Oh, that would come into the Webb Griffin area, you know, the conventional army, the lieutenants, the captains, the colonels, the generals, ladies, and so forth, because that was a traditional army.
Uh-huh.
I'm a battalion executive officer, fully trained, Cold War experience from, and I mention that because the experience of the Cold War warrior in Europe was basic training that I have used throughout the military and even in my civilian life. They drilled so diligently in Europe in those early 60s that we brought, in fact, the matter is, it was more difficult running exercises in Hohenfels and Grafenwehr and Waldflicken than it was in combat. All you had to do was come home alive in combat. You were successful. Mm-hmm. Big thing.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
But in running a training exercise in Hohenfels at double time with somebody over your shoulder critiquing every step that you went, it was a different kind of pressure, mm-hmm. not life or death, but you learned your trade. So that when I wound up in Vietnam in the 1st Infantry Division, all those skills that were gained in the 3rd Infantry Division in Europe were put to practice in the 1st Infantry Division.
Okay. When you started to think of writing, why did you focus on your first tour?
That's a great question.
That's what I try to do here.
Well, you did a great job.
He's thinking.
That was probably the best year of my life, if I think about that personally. You went in as an advisor into the Mekong Delta. We had a very broad mission. In fact, we had no mission statement at all. We made up our own. You were advising a district chief who was a soldier in his own right
mm-hmm.
on military affairs. You couldn't tell him what to do, but you could help him do what he wanted to do and hope he would do the right thing and take your suggestions as to what was the right thing. As it had turned out, it was more like a Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's court as the first American advisor team, five-man team, into a district. There wasn't anything you said to the district chief that didn't make it better, whether it was military or civilian management. And the next thing you knew, you got into civic action programs, and you've got a medic, you've got an operations sergeant, you've got a radio telephone operator, and an assistant, officer assistant. And you're spending more time building aid stations. My medic put into operation a maternity clinic, and he was so involved in that that you'd have thought that he sired the first child, and he denied that. but
okay, I was going to ask what his name was, but I'm not going there now.
Actually, it was a cat. There were Catholic nuns that managed that maternity clinic,
mm-hmm.
and our government, the organization was USOM at the time. It's the contemporary as USAID. they issued to us a maternity kit. And this is a great big footlocker of tools and implements that I've never seen in my life before. None of us men standing around there ever saw any instruments like that before. And we're trying to figure out what. Along came this little nun, and she pushed us away and took charge of that big
box.
I'll
bet she did. Well, tell me about your writing. You know, I introduced the show by saying we wanted to look a little bit at the terror and torment and tribulation. Did you feel any of that as you were writing?
Yes. Filtered by Time, that is the title, because it took 40 years for me to be able to really look at that.
Did it? Wow.
Things that in the book are related or humorous were not funny at the time.
Mm-hmm.
In retrospect, as I thought back and relayed them in the book, the dark feelings that came up again. But in this case, they were more than feelings. They became words and sentences and expunged from what I had been carrying around for 40 years. Things I wasn't even aware of.
Oh.
The Connecticut Yankee thing was 90% of the time. The other 10% of the time was stark terror, for which you would not go back.
Okay. Yeah, what you're sharing and what Susan has shared just speaks so deeply to me. I spent 3 years in Ghana, West Africa, as an educator at a seminary in a bush village, and it was a traumatic time. The country went through its first bloody coup before I got to the country, the month I was to arrive, and then 6 months later it had a second coup in which they wiped out all the others who had done a coup previously in the history of the country. That was frightening for a white American, you know. We had a tribal war in our village, and I won't go into that, but what you just got done saying, Bob, I kept a journal while I was there, and I realized now it was pretty matter of fact. And when I go back to that journal now and I look at it, I'm thankful that I just was reporting, because now when I read those things, the feelings, I can still recall the feelings and the emotions that can come with that. It may be time for me now to write that
yeah.
book. Now, you've written another book.
Yes, I have.
Quite different from your first one.
Well, yes, it is. But I feel just as emotionally strong about that as I did the first one.
Well, I have not given the name of your first book. It's Filtered by Time, A True Story of Success in Vietnam. That in itself is a unique title and perspective,
yes,
isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Yeah. And then your second book is Barnyard Economics, The Little Red Hen is Right. That triggers so many kinds of thoughts, Bob. Just give us a real brief, what's this about?
Well, it's about conservative economics. And the current environment in which we live, and young people today, but probably many people of any and all ages, look at the money problems that they face on a day-to-day basis and search for answers to those kinds of problems of work and short cash, et cetera. And they think it's economics and it's all very complicated and only the government can really deal with it. And the answer is it's not that complicated. The little red hen was right. If you don't work, you don't eat. And economics can be explained in the most simple terms at the most basic model, which is the farmyard.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wrote Barnyard Economics from the perspective of the little red hen. Take all the big terms and break them down into farmyard terms. We throw in a little bit of George Orwell's Animal Farm just to make the parody round out. And two good examples of real-time people who executed Barnyard Economics. Whether it's find a need and fill it, or build a better mousetrap.
Mm-hmm.
They are sides of the same coin. And in between the definition of terms and the explanations of how money really works at the real world level, we have two examples of people who found a better mousetrap or...
I've got This is my curveball question to you. Did you grow up on a farm?
No, I did not. But my father ran away from home at the age of 11. Home was a Kansas, Hill City, Kansas, homestead in 1904. He left at 11 years old, and he never talked much about it.
Uh-huh.
You got little clips every now and then, and over a lifetime, you connected the dots. You got a pretty good idea how an 11-year-old kid in Topeka, Kansas, living on the top of a bakery, which he swept out and delivered bread for before he went to school, did his high school as an apprentice toolmaker. Unfortunately, the master died before he got his journeyman papers, so he passed himself off as a toolmaker, job hopped across the country to Dayton, Ohio. Long story, his excerpt is in the Barnyard Economics. He retired as chairman of the board of his own publicly traded company.
Oh, my. Well, I got to tell you, I did not grow up on a farm, but I grew up in areas surrounded by farms.
Yeah.
And I had aunts and uncles and cousins who were dairy farmers, crop farmers. The guy down the road from where I grew up, he was a butcher and had his own cattle. There is one thing that is common to any kind of farm, and that is colloquially called the manure pile. And so when I think of barnyard economics, that's what comes to my mind. I'm sorry, but I just had to put that out there.
Well,
you notice Andy didn't say to me about the FCC and regulations and all that. He expects better of me, but that's the way it goes. How do people be in touch with you if they want to get your books, talk more with you about your experiences and all of that?
My webpage is robertfalkender.com. And
you better spell that last name. You know how to spell it, but others don't.
Well, there's some that would question that. My English professor, perhaps, Dr. Tim. Falkender is not like the other author, Falkener. Falkender is F-A-U-L-K-E-N-D-E-R, Falkender.
Okay.
And it's Hollandish, not German. And the Kender is K-E-N-D-E-R. And it has meaning in Dutch, which I will leave you to discover should you be a student of language.
Okay. Well, let's open it up for conversation here. I just, both of you, you had to be thinking, Susan, what it must be like to be where he was and to write. I'm thinking about what you experienced out of my own little experiences in Ghana. What's going through your head right now after you've listened to him and all the things that have gone on? Do you want to pick up a pen and start writing?
Well, you know, I'm I am not far from his age in the sense that I was, you know, a product of the 60s. And I saw the guys, the boyfriends, the brothers, the mm-hmm. uncles, the dads go off to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And the interesting thing that is not, hasn't been said here is that I'm a product of a military family.
Oh, my.
And a father that went to Korea, he mm-hmm. served in World War II, came up through the ranks, was Army Air Corps into Air Force, and was a hospital administrator. And the dad that left me when I was 7 to go set up MASH units in Korea, when he returned when I was 8 and a half, was not the same daddy.
Oh, I'll bet.
His story, you know, is so much a part and of my familial experience of living with trauma.
Mm-hmm.
So the chaos that we had and the shame and the privacy that we held as a military family within the walls of our homes as we moved, and I went to 13 schools in 12 years, is the story that's not too different from whether it was the Vietnam veteran
mm-hmm.
or now the Gulf Desert Storm or Iraq, Afghanistan. And so let me go back and say, strangely enough, when that exhibition went to Hattiesburg, Mississippi, a general walked up to me and said, Susan, I'd like to know if you can adapt your program to help our U.S. military the men and women who have served and are coming back now, and we know we're going to need to help them, and the VA is not going to be enough.
Wow.
And so I felt like saying, yes, sir.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Yes, sir. And it has a very personal connection to me because I know firsthand what secondary trauma is, the trauma that is that the family experiences as a result of the change.
Sure.
In
sure.
the combat veteran or the veteran who comes back who's been traumatized.
Well, Bob, go ahead.
It's very interesting. Tomorrow I am going out to Mercer University. They are using Filtered by Time as a textbook to a social studies of combating societies. And the young people that sign up for this have no idea of the kinds of things that went on in Vietnam. And they are the second and third down the line who are experiencing what their aunt, uncle, or grandfather may, mm-hmm. and just they don't know why grandpa acts like that,
mm-hmm.
or what kind of thought is that. And they show up and they ask the strangest questions, but very penetrating. And I love going down there and sharing what this was about, because this 3 years, 5 years, 60 to 65 of advisor, most people are not aware of what we were involved in. Yet you can take the pattern of life in those days and move it right straight into Afghanistan. And I can sit with a captain from Afghanistan last year, and we have exactly the same story. It's just a difference of 40 years, 50 years,
mm-hmm.
in terms of living in the village.
Sure.
And what's going on and what he's experiencing.
And that's what we see in our program. We see the older generation veteran who wants to help comes and takes our workshop and basically realizes they can become a peer trainer, an ArtReach
wow.
peer trainer that then serves the younger generation who are coming back because the stories are very similar.
Do you have workshops in which
yes.
you offer this training?
Sure, absolutely. This is an ongoing service that the ArtReach Foundation is constantly doing. And we have a cadre of trainers, some that have come out of the military,
mm-hmm.
Who are using our program both in their settings and in their place of business. But at the same time, we're using them in our ongoing training workshops.
Okay.
Yeah.
Bob, what has spoken to you about Susan? Because you've been trumpeting her cause for quite some time.
Wow.
Gee, I have to work on that. I first off identify her as an entrepreneur.
Mm-hmm.
She's action-oriented. And what Barnyard Economics will establish is that productivity is where the whole thing starts.
Okay.
The idea of wanting or having a need is passive. It's defense. The only thing that wins the ball game is offense. The only thing that scores points is offense. She is offense. Her mind, emotion, and attitude said, I got to do something. I'm going to Bosnia. I don't know
well,
what.
Well, that's on the top of everyone's list, isn't it?
Yeah.
Whoa.
Well, sure. Can I go tomorrow?
Sure.
Interestingly enough, one of my classmates' wives and I were in conversation at a reunion this spring. And she says, I'm going to Bosnia. And I said, oh, really? Like everybody goes to Bosnia for vacation. I said, what are you going to? Well, I've been there so many times, and she tells me her story. I said, would you happen to know Susan Anderson? Bing, like a light bulb. And they've been roaming around in the Balkans for years together. I don't understand it. So. What
amazing.
Have I missed?
You know, can I share a story that triggers one? I met an individual at a workshop probably 15 years ago, who had just come back from Ghana. And I asked her what it was like, and she said, what did you say your name was? And I told her, and she said, I was in this remote village where they have this big cross. I said, yeah, Mejafe. She says, yeah, the chief asked me if I knew you. I said, well, now you do. Yeah. Yeah, these things do happen.
Well, they did.
You cannot underestimate the impression you're making on just one that could go to many.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So do you do any writing, or what's your art? What's your art? What do you do to get all this stuff out? Or you just teach it, right?
I wish I could say I could fully identify what my art is. I think I just like people, and I like bringing people together. I've had remarkable experiences. Many people have said, you need to start writing. You know, this has been going on now for almost 14 years. You need to be writing these memories, these thoughts, and I get started and I back off because I don't feel I am a writer. And I've learned how to be a storyteller. I had to actually, Tim, overcome phobic public speaking. I was terrified of public speaking.
I see. And that makes it hard to raise money.
Yeah. Well, I don't. I mean, the worst thing, the terror I have is asking for money. And so as a result, you know, we're not a big, well-supported foundation, but we've got a lot of stories to tell, and I guess there's nobody else that's going to really be able to tell the story, but as I am still living, the founder, even though I keep trying to give this foundation to everybody else, take it, run with it, because I think it's an initiative. I think we make the case for why you don't get rid of the arts in education.
Absolutely.
It's part of the whole development of the being. Mm-hmm. And it'll make you a better student. We know that. And yet the first thing that goes, and I can get on my soapbox with this, first thing that goes is get rid of the arts. But
your
it is the arts that connects us. It forms our how we think logically and in a process kind of way. And right now it's like I have a lot to say, but I don't know how to write. And I don't think of myself as a writer.
A lot of people don't. I'll bet you. Did you think of yourself as a writer, or did you just start?
No. If my wife hadn't given me that little class to join up with, and that was the best thing that ever happened, because the gal who taught the class made me write a chapter every week, and that began the discipline. And down as you unfold, and then you get into it, and then the characters take over, getting on to the
finish.
Then it goes,
doesn't it?
But it takes that start, and this is, and Susan and I had a conversation on the way over here. Is it getting started and getting in the discipline of writing it? And Dr. Tim, I think you have a client here. This young lady.
Let's put her on the spot. Okay? Yes. Let's just put in front of God and everybody.
Absolutely. I'm sort of entrepreneurial, aggressive.
I heard that. Well, you know what? This is what we call not so much Saved by the Bell, but the clock is on us, which means I got to bring her to a close. And we welcome your comments and suggestions about content and our guests. If you'd like to recommend a guest or be a guest yourself on Right Here, Right Now, let us know. All I'll ask you to do is send me an email at whwnbusinessradiox@gmail.com. Andy, you were really quiet today.
Well, you never took a break for me to get in there. You know?
I was watching out of the corner of my eye. You never got up to the mic, but thanks for being there.
Actually,
really.
The one question I had, and I'd just like to point this out before we quit, Susan actually covered right at the end, which is, you know, I think there's a lot of value in what you guys are doing and what you're talking about and the arts and language and what it does to the human emotional spirit. And we've been talking a lot about military, but this really covers the gambit of the human essence. And I really think it was great that you brought that up at the end.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks, Andy. And thanks for always being there to make this go out.
One thumbs up like.
You like? And thank you to our guests, Susan Anderson and Bob Falkender. Susan, your contact information again, please.
You can write me at susan@artreachfoundation.org and visit our website, artreachfoundation.org, and learn about Project America if you have an interest. And we are grateful for all contributions of any kind and involvement in our program, because there's a lot of work to do. The VA just can't do it all.
Great. And Bob, your contact information.
Yes, my webpage is robertfalkender.com, and that's FaulkenderFalkender, okay. Robert Falkender.com.
Great. Well, Right Here, Right Now is brought to you each week by Right Choice Services, and you can learn more about Right Choice Services and how we help individuals write the book they've always wanted to write at our website, www.write, that's spelled W-R-I-T-E, choiceservices.com. I hope you will join us next week and tell your friends about the show. Send them an email, pick up your phone, your cell phone, whatever. Encourage them to listen live or to the downloads. Right Here, Right Now, broadcast live every Tuesday morning at 10 a.m. Eastern Time at righterightnow.businessradiox.com. And the MP3 version is available later today. I am Tim Morrison. Join us next time when business leaders, entrepreneurs, and professionals come together to discuss the power of the pen and its impact on their business right here, right now.